probably no issue has, you know, transformed or fixated the world in general, the Jewish people in particular, and Orthodox Judaism in particular, as the role of women. The changes that have been made in the last 25 years, since I was a kid, are really astounding. And I don't even know if even some of our panelists realized what it was like when I was a kid. They weren't, you know, born yet. It's really a totally different world. And that's what we're here tonight to discuss, what are the limits. So it's I'm sure it'll be a wonderful evening. We had a wonderful evening last night in New York. We did sort of, you know, round one. And Achron Chaviv, here we're doing round two. So I'll let Elliot take over for the program. And that's it. Enjoy. Thank you. I do want to thank Or Torah Stone for their co-sponsorship of the program, Rabbi Riskin, and their whole institution that are co-sponsors. I want to mention that and offer Hakara Tatov.
Okay. Hi, I'm Dr. Elliot Malamut. The subject of this evening, Orthodox Women and Leadership, really pertains to the fact that I think that there's a general sense in the Orthodox Jewish world that we live in a time of unprecedented opportunities and choices for Jewish women in the realm of Torah study for sure, as well as involvement in communal prayer, positions of leadership. And for the last number of years, the discussion of these matters throughout the community lead to often very passionate and sometimes even very heated arguments. And I think that's a testimony to the centrality and the significance of the issues that are involved. Back when, the evolution took place in things like women's prayer groups, Megillah readings, the recitation of Birkat HaGomel and Kaddish, and obviously high-level Torah learning for the last number of decades. Recently, the changes are more dramatic and involve things like partnership minyanim, women in clerical positions, and so on, and they've been advocated for and just as vociferously pushed back against. So I think that tonight we're really very happy to bring together these three women of great vision and accomplishment to take a closer look at the relevant issues involved. So I'm going to introduce them to you in alphabetical order. Over here on the far right is Sarah Chessis, who along with her husband Rabbi Noah Chessis served for 3 years as the co-directors of the Self-Jewish Learning Initiative on campus, the JLIC. That was at Yale. And they're continuing this work as part-time JLIC educators for university students in Toronto. Sarah is a graduate of the Yoetzot Halacha program at Nishmat in Jerusalem, and she's trained to advise women in Taharat HaMishpacha and women's health. She holds a master's degree in public health from Columbia and a BA in biology with honors from Stern College. Next to me on my left is Lila Kagedin, is part of the 2015 class at Yeshivat Maharat Manhattan. She's a consultant, educator, practitioner in the areas of global health, applied and theoretical ethics, religion, and education. She's taught Talmud and Jewish studies in a variety of formal and non-formal settings. And she's also written extensively on medicine and halakha and on topics relating to women and Judaism and Jewish practice. She holds a master's in education from the University of Toronto and a master's in theological studies from Harvard. Dr. Jenny Rosenfeld is currently enrolled in a 5-year program at the Susie Bradfield Women's Institute for Halachic Leadership at Midrashat Lindenbaum in Jerusalem, where women are being ordained to give instruction and rulings in Jewish law, according to Rabbi Shmuel Klitzner, who's the head of the program, the director of the institute. Dr. Rosenfeld's appointment as the communal spiritual leader of Efrat by Rabbi Shlomo Riskin is really the first time a woman in modern Israel has been designated to an official position of Orthodox communal religious leadership. Dr. Rosenfeld is also the author of a book which emerged out of her doctoral thesis. The book is called The Newlywed's Guide to Physical Intimacy, and it's a sexual education book aimed at Orthodox Jews. Please welcome our speakers. So this is the second go-round for Dr. Rosenfeld and myself. We did this 24 hours ago in Manhattan. One of the things I realized is that I think it would be helpful for everybody to define what it is that they do. I think that there are terms that are thrown around in the Jewish world that some people are very current with and others not so much. When you say things like Yoetzot or Poskot or Manhiga Ruchani and so on. So I'm going to ask everybody just to talk a little bit about what their training is and what it is that they do. Let's start with you, Sarah. What is a yoetzet halacha?
Sure. The term, first of all, before I start, I want to thank you and Rabbi Kalman for inviting us here tonight. It's really an honor to be here with these two incredible women and share this discussion with everyone here in the room. So yoetzet halacha means, translation, is advisor in Jewish law, and the training of yoetzet halacha is through Nishmat, which is based in Yerushalayim. And we learn the laws related to Tahara Mishpachat, those of Nitzah and Nekva, through the biblical sources all the way through modern times, in order to advise women in this area of halacha. Additionally, we receive training in women's health, psychology, sexuality, that might help us help women in their questions or advise them through topics that are related to mikvah and nidza.
Okay. Also want to echo the thanks for being here this evening and honored to serve with you guys as well. So the program at which I study, the Susie Bradfield Institute of Women's Institute of Halachic Leadership at Midreshet Lindenbaum, trains women in a 5-year program. It is actually the first program to train women towards a Heter Hora. Heter Hora is the same thing as smicha. So women are trained in areas of Shabbos, Nida, Isser V'Heter, Chuppah Kiddushin, Avelot, the same things that are learned for smicha. And at the end of the 5 years, receive a Heter Hora from Rabbi Riskin, who I understand was here just a few months ago, as well as our Rosh Kolel, Rav Shuki Reich. Two women have already completed the Heter Hora several years ago and have been answering halachic questions since then, and as well as writing tshuvot, halachic responsa. My job in Efrat as a manhigah ruchanit comes while I'm still in the middle of my studies, but the basic goal of the position is that there be a woman to answer not only halachic questions, but questions of religious guidance as well. It's a very new position in Israel, unlike in the US where you have maharats serving in clerical roles. In Israel, you don't have, clergy roles. In Israel, you don't really have that yet. And so a lot of what I'm doing at this point is just exploring what are the questions and what is the need. And hopefully I get to say a little bit more about it.
It's wonderful to be here back at home in Canada and to reconnect with colleagues and friends from Yale and from Midreshet Lindenbaum several years ago. I'm in a program, as you already heard, in Yeshivat Maharat, where, God willing, I'll receive smicha in a month. And our program is fundamentally like any Orthodox smicha program that you might be familiar with, either from Yeshiva University, Yeshiva Chovei Torah, the Rabbanut in Israel. We study and are trained to answer questions and to be poskot halacha on issues of kashrut, shabbat, gerut, nida, iser v'heter, all of the components really of a traditional Orthodox smicha program. We also do have a focus on pastoral care and some work in chaplaincy as well that we study over a 4-year rigorous program. And our graduates who have received smicha from three rabbanim who are affiliated with Yeshivat Maharat, Rabbi Daniel Sperber from Israel, Rabbi Jeffrey Fox in New York, and Rabbi Weiss in New York, are serving in a variety of Orthodox synagogues around America and, of course, here in Canada and Montreal at the Shar, and are serving in leadership roles and also answering halacha questions and serving communities in a variety of ways in their communities.
Okay, so we've just heard a kind of summary of the kinds of things you do, very impressive, broad things. And it's interesting to me because historically women were not, for the most part, in the forefront of religious and halachic leadership, with some notable exceptions. But today, you've seen there are yotzot, there are people getting smicha, there are obviously women who are top-level Talmud learners and teachers, people leading minyanim, day schools, seminaries, the whole lot. So obviously modernity is different, and what I wanted to do is to ask all of you, starting with you, Sarah Chessis, why is modernity different? In other words, why has female leadership risen to be one of the central issues of the Orthodox community? What does that say about the way the community has changed? And what is it that women can sort of bring to the table in leadership that maybe men cannot, or what is it that they add to it?
Thank you. Good question there. So the first half about why now, I think the main difference that we have in our world today is high level of Torah education for women. You know, my grandmother, when she was growing up in Xenia, Ohio, her parents hired someone to teach her and her three brothers Hebrew and Torah, and he only agreed to teach her brothers. So she never learned Hebrew, and now she's in her 80s, she's trying, it's a lot harder. But you know, in her generation, the question of having women serving in roles of religious leadership was not even a question. If you can't speak the language, you can't read the text, it's not even a question to ask. You know, fast forwarding to our generation, you know, I was privileged enough to receive a wonderful Jewish education through Torah, Gemara. One of my favorite subjects was actually Gemara in school. I went on to study in Israel, to Stern, to Nishmat. And these are just some examples of all the institutions of higher learning for women in our day. So now that women, you know, can have the education in Torah, in Halacha, in Gemara, in Jewish thought, now the question is, how can they use that to help our communities? And how can they bring their knowledge and their passion and their talents and their skills to our communities to teach people and to guide people in their observance of mitzvot? So I think that's what modernity has, number one, compared to the other generations. The second half of your question is what can women offer? So I'll speak from my experience as a yoatzet. And I'll say that what women can offer is truly significant in the fact that they're women. Nothing to the fault of men. You know, we don't choose how we're created. But the fact that, you know, I deal with the area of halacha, of nidah, and mikvah, which is a very intimate matter. Again, for a lot of women, they're comfortable talking to the rabbi about these things, and that's great. But for many women, they're not. So what was happening was women were not asking questions. They felt very alone in their observance of these mitzvot. And that's really unfortunate. So the fact that there's women who are now trained to answer questions, to be a resource in this, makes a huge difference. Rabbi Alman, who runs the Nishmat branch of the Yotzah program in America, they opened up a branch a few years ago to meet the need of the American Jewish community. He's told us several times that the Yotzot he speaks to receive questions all the time that he had never received in all his years in the rabbinate. Because as warm and as nice as he tries to be, he can't match the openness and comfort that women have speaking to other women about it. So I think, you know, the fact that women have women to turn to really makes a difference in how they're able to feel comfortable keeping the mitzvot and keep it more correctly.
Yeah, I just want to jump off and say kind of a different aspect, which is what women can offer not only to other women, but to the entire community. And one of the things that I've seen since I started working in Efrat is I think I came in with the Yoetzet model in mind, expecting women would reach out to me. And I've been very surprised that in the 3 months that I've been there, I've received probably about an equal number of requests and meetings with men and women. So I think that that's also something where it's less of an intimate matter, so it's less clear why a man is coming to speak to me about a particular issue or a woman about a different issue. But I think that female halachic leadership is needed really for the entire community and not just for women. So
I wanted to ask you if you think that the idea that women are here to lead the entire community, which is a good idea and hopefully an idea that will be fulfilled, but do you think that men currently and in the future will have hesitation about approaching female leaders for halachic guidance, probably because of a kind of entrenched way of thinking.
There's no question that this will take some time, and it has taken time, frankly. Though, just as men have gotten used to going to women who are physicians, we have a woman on the Supreme Court, both in Canada and the US, and men and the entire community got used to it, and it also took time. It is my belief that men will also get used to approaching women for halachic matters. I think many of us had the experience of asking our mothers halachic questions about kashrut and about Shabbat. And I, for one, had a very brilliant, scholarly father, Aleph HaShalom. But when I had halachic questions in the kitchen, I asked my mother. And she knows her stuff. And I believe that this model, actually, for asking women questions and for approaching women with complex matters is actually more comfortable than we might already think. To a certain degree, it's an issue of aesthetics. We aren't used to seeing women in front and center roles in our synagogue life, though it's becoming much more common. And I do believe that we're not only getting used to it, but also benefiting from it. And as it becomes more normal, I think our children, our children's children, will see this truly as normal.
You know, one of the reasons I'm asking you this is that there's all this literature that came out of the Reform and conservative movements in the last 15 to 20 years about the fact that as women increasingly moved into leadership positions in these denominations, men dropped out. Men dropped out in really significant numbers from going to shul, from being part of the synagogue, being part of the scene, partly as a, you know, possibly what I would call the men's club sort of syndrome. And I want to read to you something and have you comment on it. There's a conservative Jewish rabbi named Scott Perlow who printed the following column in the Washington Post. And look what he has to say. This is obviously not an orthodoxy. He says many of his congregants, even young, otherwise liberal Jews, don't like the idea of a female rabbi. He writes, I remember the mother who wanted to switch from another synagogue so that her daughter's bat mitzvah would not be performed by a woman. I remember the professional 30-something woman who confessed that she didn't like her local rabbi because the rabbi was female. When asked their reasons, this population said that the idea of a female rabbi just doesn't feel right. And that's it, they weren't comfortable. And these are comments not from an older generation and not from a halachically observant generation. These are people who supported gender equality in other places in the world, right? And if you talk to many Orthodox men, they'll say things like, I'm not comfortable in partnership minyan, it's like a women's thing, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the reason I asked the question. In other words, is there almost going to be a kind of segregated rabbinate where women talk to maratz and men still tend towards, you know, male rabbis? And if that's so, is there a way to get around that? Is there a way to change that?
So in the spirit of full disclosure, Rabbi Scott Perlow is a colleague, and I remember when I read this article, and I think it had a lot of insight. I tend to think that more is more in the way of good, productive leadership. And I don't have a concern that the rabbinate will be segregated. I think that people who are well equipped to do the job will go and do this work. This is work that needs to be done. It's holy work, it's God's work, and it's work really that is responded to because an individual has a calling, irrespective of gender. And I'm personally not concerned about this idea of a segregated rabbinate because actually we see in our shul life, in our synagogue life, and in our Jewish life, different people that take on different roles. Men, women, children, people who are youth directors, people who all, rabbis who all contribute to our Jewish life, Jewish educators. And in actuality, they've been welcomed. For example, synagogue leadership is no longer only male. We don't only have male teachers in our Jewish schools. In fact, some people will say that they're strongest teachers, Gemara teachers at Maimonides School in Boston are women. So I think, again, the change comes slowly, but I am very optimistic that men and women can work together, really, to achieve the ultimate goal, which is having an accessible and very enriching Jewish leadership.
Dr. Rosenfeld, you pointed out before that you see the emergence of women as leaders as a communal issue. In other words, how they can best serve the Jewish community, as opposed to, I guess, the issue of it being a human rights issue or, of course, a feminist issue. Would you say that the emergence of these roles, whether it's a female rabbi or a yoetzet halacha or whatever names we want to call it, as not having to do with feminism, strictly having to do with Jewish communal service, or do you see it as in some way an expression of female empowerment as we move into the 21st century? How would you frame this?
Okay. So firstly, I think in general, when I would frame it, I wouldn't frame it in strictly feminist terms because it's not something that I'm comfortable with. However, I think also in light of last night's panel and some of the comments that were made there, I think that we obviously have to put on the table and acknowledge that none of us would have the opportunities that we have as women today if it were not for the feminist revolution. So clearly this is an outgrowth of that. But if we take the question of, okay, it's an outgrowth of the feminist revolution and we have a lot to be grateful for, I think for me personally, the next step of moving into this field is more of a communal issue and a feeling of wanting to serve the community. And again, I want to stress, especially in light of the previous question, wanting to serve both the men and the women in the community, because I think Lila brought up the example of a doctor. It's something that really goes both ways. There are men that prefer going to a female doctor. There are women that prefer going to a male doctor. But I think that we need, with halachic leadership also, the range of options so that people can choose who do they feel comfortable with and who do they feel comfortable asking that particular question to.
All three of you can answer this. When you tell people what you do or what you are or what your title is, do you ever meet resistance? Do you ever get people saying, not just what's that, but like, why are you doing that?
Yes.
So tell me about that.
I think we all do.
Tell me about that.
Most of the time, it's about ignorance in terms of not knowing what I do and what it means. Often people think I'm a maharat. They sound kind of similar. Yeah, what's a maharat, you know? So people don't really know exactly the difference between everything. So I think most of the time it's, you know, just about what is it exactly. And then when I explain what it is, they have very little to say back to me, honestly, in terms of how this could be bad. When I say that I'm helping women, I'm helping marriages and couples and Jewish couples keep the laws pertaining to their marriage in a more comfortable way that is correct, that makes them feel dignified and empowered. Like, what can you really say back to that?
That is a kind of a showstopper right there, yeah. but I'm imagining that you, Lila, and you, Jenny, probably do get a little bit more of that. I think of the three titles. Currently in Orthodoxy, the sort of Yoetzet Halacha has the easiest, kind of smoothest ride. And I think when it comes to titles that sort of start to verge on a rabbinic title, it probably has less of an easy ride. Do you ever encounter resistance? And how do you counter it? What do you say back?
So I'll tell you, I think that most of the resistance that I've encountered has been resistance that I haven't even actually met face-to-face. There have been a lot of things online, and the truth is I take the luxury of the fact that they're all written in Hebrew and they're all over the internet of just saying, like, forget about it, I'm not even gonna read it. If someone's interested in speaking to me, then they'll contact me, and just by the selective process, the people who have contacted me are only the people who are in favor of this role and wanna hear more about it. So I haven't actually kind of encountered the enemy in the way that you seem to have encountered.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
So I would say of the three, probably the Maharat title is it's actually the most curious to me, right? You're probably, you know, intimately aware of all of the sort of casuistry that went into like parsing titles when it came to the Maharat. I just want to read that the RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America, in March 2010 issued a statement that we're gratified that during the course of our conversations, Rabbi Avi Weiss concluded that neither he nor Yeshivat Maharat would ordain women as rabbis, and that Yeshivat Maharat will not confer the title of rabbah on graduates of their program. And even Rabbi Weiss remarked, it's not about title, it's about a degree. It's about women having earned the right to be postcote. And Maharat Rachel Cole Feingold, as you mentioned, is in Montreal, said, I'm a member of the clergy, but I don't use the word rabbi in my head. People get caught up with the title, but for me, it's about the function. It's about what I do. There's something to me that's a little funny about this. You know, like if you went to law school for many years, you'd want to be called a lawyer. And if you went to med school, you wouldn't just say, you don't have to call me doctor. I'm just more about healing people. You can call me whatever you like. I'm dubious that we'd apply that kind of logic. And yet it seems that we have a lot of trouble pulling the trigger on what seems like a fairly obvious thing. Why do you think that is?
I'm glad you asked. The controversy around the title of Rabbah, which was granted to Rabbah Sarah Hurwitz, the first woman who was ordained by Rabbi Weiss, and the first woman who was ordained in the Orthodox tradition in America, certainly, was a tremendously stressful time. And frankly, I think it was a terribly divisive time for the Jewish people. And Rabbi Weiss, who is certainly a mentor to me and my rabbi, struggled with this. And there were many articles written and tears shed. And ultimately, there was this decision to grant a title of Maharat to the women who received smicha, who were ordained from the program. Now, interestingly, in that comment, Rabbi Weiss said, Yeshivat Maharat is a degree-granting institution, and it is. The yeshiva will give a klef smicha to its graduates. It is for the graduates to take on their title, depending on their hiring institution, and perhaps depending on what it is, as Maharat Rachel said, they hear in their own mind, in their own heart. Thus far, the women who have been ordained have taken on the title of Maharat. Though actually, even just this week, in Los Angeles, a woman who is going to be ordained in a year has taken on the title of Moratenu. In fact, her Orthodox synagogue in LA spent a tremendous amount of time struggling, and they came up with this title together. So we have Moratenu. We have a Gemara teacher named Devorah Zlotchauer who is called Chachama. This is new. This is very new, and we're trying to figure it out. All that being said, as the name and the title has evolved, and it has continued to evolve, it will continue to evolve. There will be women who take on other titles. There will be women who take on the title of Rabbah, because that is a call in their heart or in their mind or of their host institution. And there will be women who work in a variety of environments where the word Maharat would be very hard to explain. My youngest brother actually said, when I first started the program, Maha what? And I actually think that that is very telling. I work in clinical ethics in a hospital, and I work in chaplaincy. And I'm in a graduate program at Harvard. And at Harvard University, people don't know what Maharat is. At the Harvard teaching hospitals, they don't know what Maharat is. So the best I can say is, I'm going to be ordained. They say, you're going to be ordained, so you're going to be a... And in their mind, certainly, I will be ordained as a rabbi. There's right. No question.
So if they called you rabbi, you wouldn't correct them?
I would not correct them, as the preparation that I have done is exactly parallel to the program and to the study of all of my male colleagues who are rabbis.
So if it walks like a rabbi and it talks like a rabbi and it's trained like a rabbi and it acts like a rabbi, why do we have so much trouble saying rabbi, do you think?
I think it depends who you ask. I wouldn't say that everybody does have trouble saying rabbi. And I don't know that everybody in the future will have as much trouble saying rabbi. I do think, as I said before, there is a discomfort around a certain aesthetic. We are used to women having certain titles. Frankly, we're used to women having no titles. And what I always say when people approach me, yell at me, argue with me, is again this idea that change comes slowly, but we get used to it. If a physician came in the room, and if I went to see a physician and I went to see Dr. Brenda Weitzner, and she said, "Hi, my name is Brenda," I would say, "What are you doing here? What do you do?" As soon as she says, "I'm Dr. Brenda Weitzner," I know exactly what she does. I know exactly how to use her skill set and how I can benefit from her and what I need.
So you're raising the issue, which, you know, I think is of crucial importance here, which is timing and how fast a community can catch up to what it is that women do and are going to continue to do. And Dr. Rosenfeld, you noted previously that famous comment by Rabbi Yitz Greenberg that you can only be about 5 to 10% ahead of your community if you want to successfully influence them. You can't be too far over the line. So we're going to play a little game here called Too Fast, Too Slow. And I want you to both comment on things in the Orthodox community that you think are moving too quickly and things that you think aren't moving quickly enough. If you can give me one example, or if you can't do both, just do one. Do you think there's something that we need to move quicker on? Let's start with you, Sarah Chess.
That's a hard game. I guess I'll give a very concrete example to this community, which is that in America, there are many shuls that have hired Yowetzot to work for their shuls, for their community, to serve the women and the couples in their towns. And Toronto, I live here, and actually there's another Yowetzot who lives here as well, Rivka Sonnenberg, who's been here for about 10 years. But this community, you know, as of yet, has not made an official position for Yowetzot. We both help a lot of people because that's what we enjoy doing. We enjoy helping women in helping marriages. And I would say we are working on creating such a position in Toronto. If you want to help us out, send me afterwards. But we're working on it, but it's slow, you know, and I think that change is slow. And I will, of course, would love to see it be a little faster, but I understand that change is slow.
Okay. I'm shocked to hear this about the Toronto Orthodox community. Dr. Rosenfeld.
Okay, so to take a very different example of something that's moving too slow, and we'll see if any of us talk about what's moving too quickly. I think that the procedures around Gyur and the immersion of female converts is something which has long needed some type of tikkun, some type of change, of fixing, and it's not happening yet. I think we had a very big wake-up call a few months ago as to how strong the need is for change around this issue, and I hope that things will speed up in that realm.
Let's talk about that for a bit. As many of you know, next Friday afternoon, actually, May 15th, 2015, Rabbi Barry Freundel will be sentenced on 52 counts of voyeurism for having set up cameras and secretly filmed women in the mikveh. The assistant U.S. attorney named A.B. Zubrinsky noted that in addition to the camera and a clock radio, Freundel had taped them using mini cameras embedded in a tissue box and a tabletop fan. He faces a maximum of 1 year in jail and a fine of up to $2,500 on each of the first 30 counts and a $1,000 fine on the remainder, which means either he will spend the rest of his life in jail or not at all or something in between. I'm not here to talk about this case. It's engendered enough commentary, but I am, you know, very interested given the context that you're raising, which is that the Orthodox community is dropping the ball when it comes to mikveh, conversion, et cetera, the sequence. So let's get more specific in light of what happened here. From what you're saying, and I want you all to weigh in here, you don't believe that the process is okay just as it is, because obviously there are some people who argue in the wake of this that it's a good process, it's just that Rabbi Freundel abused a good process. But what I'm hearing from you is that you believe that conversion needs a certain kind of alteration, and a certain kind of alteration involving women's involvement. So I'd like you to flesh that out a little bit for me and tell me what it is that you think should be the alterations and how women, especially women in leadership positions, can help.
Okay. I think that there's a very strong halachic argument to be made, at the least, for women serving as emissaries of the Beit Din, Shluchot Beit Din, and witnessing the conversion of women. It's something that has its roots even in the Gemara Masachet Yevamos, where it talks about the tefillah, the immersion of a man versus the tefillah of a woman. There's a clear distinction in the way that the Gemara speaks about it. There's also a wonderful article by the Rabbanit Michal Tukachinsky available online, where she goes through the early sources to the later sources in support of this idea. There's a famous tshuva of Rav Uziel, who allowed in a specific situation women to serve as shlichot beit din. And I think it's about taking those sources and simply putting them into practice and saying that as a first step, that's what's going to happen. A further step, which is more controversial, would be having women serve on the Beit Din as the actual Beit Din for Gior. It's an argument that has been made by some, including our Rosh Kol El Rav Shuki Reich, that a Beit Din for Gior is different than a traditional Beit Din, and that women can serve on the Beit Din itself. But I see that as a step kind of for way in the future, because we certainly don't want to do anything that would compromise people's Jewish status.
I think that Jenny spoke very articulately. I'll just add that this comment that Rabbi Freundel was one perpetrator, the entire practice of allowing a man to have dominion over, control over a space that is predominantly used by women is just ripe for abuse. And this is really an opportunity for leadership and halachic leadership, but also common sense. I would really like to offer a voice of reason to our Jewish tradition and to make sure that mikvaot are really in the hands of women. There isn't a strong reason why not. And some mikvaot have actually already made the change. There's a mikvah in Boston already that the Rav Amachshir is from Lakewood. I answer the halacha questions and open the mikvah, close the mikvah, along with some women that I have trained to do that and manage the bor, manage the entire operation. This was largely due to the response to this this terrible crime and this terrible issue. I'll also say, in the situation of Giyur, since there is a precedent, since we have texts already that exist that we can draw from, it's time to use those texts. It's time to make them practical. And I'm not sure that I see a Beit Din for Giyur so far off in the future that is of women on it. And it's true, we need to make sure that we do this in a way that does not in any way compromise the kashrut of these conversions. And I also hope that we don't wait for further abuse to happen in other areas before we safeguard our community with its proper leaders, male or female.
Sarah, I'm just trying to get an understanding of the balance between when a community moves too slowly and too quickly, and in a way, like, how do you know? Like, what's the sense of, I realize that's a difficult thing to pin down, but because obviously there's a tension between taking an idea, if a community moves too quickly and it loses its adherence, so it's a bad thing. If it moves too slowly and injustice is perpetrated, that's a bad thing. So this is a very delicate balance, and I'm wondering if you have any sort of intuition or sense of, like, how it gets maintained.
I think that's the number one question. I wish I had an easy answer for that. You know, balancing, as you articulated, you know, keeping the community together, refraining from becoming divisive in the community, at the same time implementing positive changes for our community, you know, these are really in tension with each other. So I'm honestly not sure how to strike that balance, but I do think that there are, like I say, two factors that are important to keep in mind. So one, I think, is the pace. And as I mentioned, it's slow, it's not fast. I think the changes that come about slowly and gradually will be more sustainable, more accepted, more successful than changes that happen radically as a little change for our community. You know, they joke how many Orthodox Jews does it take to change a light bulb? Change? What? You know, so, you know, we don't like change suddenly like that. So something that's slowly and gradual is more likely to be successful. That's one factor. Second of all, I think it matters who's driving the change and who's supporting the change. Because I know for, I'll speak to the ESSET program, you mentioned that it is more, it's accepted for the most part in our communities. In Israel, you know, amongst the Dati Limud community, it's completely accepted. It's not even a question at all about women always turn to Yotzah, without a doubt. And I think part of the reason it's been so successful is it was happening gradually and it had rabbinic support behind it. You know, Rav Lichtenstein, who just passed away, was a big supporter of it. Other bigger Rebbeim in Israel were supported it and endorsed it. And similarly in America, when the Yotzah American program graduated its first class, they had 40 modern Orthodox rabbis sign on to their honorary rabbinic committee supporting what they were doing. So I think, you know, having that support, that public rabbinic support, is a key factor in helping change be successful in our community.
Yeah, I guess this question also kind of brings me back to the question that you asked at the beginning in terms of the title of rabbi. And I think that perhaps one other thing that is needed for successful change is respecting where the community is at. And I think that the fact that the title rabbi gets such a negative visceral reaction is something that that we need to respect and we need to honor and then move forward along with that.
Now, I'm assuming when you say where the community is at, that like in politics, everything is local, right? In other words, there are different kind of communities. Where I live, which is in Baca in South Jerusalem, it's a very different kind of community than even, you know, I could just cross Rehov Yafo and I'm in a different universe, really. So, you know, when we talk about an Orthodox community, we're really talking about very different entities in very different places. So would you say that it's really that sensitized, like there are micro communities and you have to really know like what your local constituency is about and being sensitive to that. Having said that, does that set up the prospect of completely fractured orthodoxy, you know, where all of these micro communities have very, very different standards? In that sense, then, how do we then talk about a larger framework for a Jewish nation? Whoever wants to take it.
Well, I'll first say that I don't want to use the word fractured, and I would prefer to steer away from the word divided. But orthodoxy looks different in different places. This is what it is. It looks different in Canada. It looks different in the U.S. I grew up in Ottawa. I lived in Toronto. It looks different everywhere. And so our definition of orthodoxy, I think, is relatively fluid, actually. I do think this is the reason that Rabbi Weiss, in many ways, said that different communities will bestow a title onto different women in their leadership roles in their community, depending on where it is. And I think that the synagogues, the shuls that have hired women already, who have been ordained by Maharat, certainly have these women working in different roles. They are all available to the community, but they have different jobs depending on the setting that they're in. They answer to different specific needs. Some focus more on the community mikvah, some focus more on specific teaching, some are always available for kashrut questions, some take call for kashrut or Shabbat questions, and some officiate at Jewish life cycle events, some do not. And this, I think, is the answer. It's putting the most prepared person in the role, and then once they're in the role, they'll navigate through the messiness, like everybody does in a new job or in a new setting, and will determine how best they can serve the community.
I want to just turn the discussion a little bit towards the personal and ask you all what you think the effect of women in professional realm has on women as partners, women as mothers, and so on. I'm specifically referring to a real outgrowth of feminist literature in the last, certainly the last 10 years, even 15 years, almost kind of post-feminist discourse, remarking on the idea that maybe professional life has taken too big a toll on women's family life. And I'm wondering, see, on the one hand, right, girls growing up today may take it for granted that a Jewish woman can serve as a Jewish leader. That is good. That's crucial as a potential model for our daughters. But on the other hand, can too much professional commitment create stress on family life? Can that be a bad thing? And I guess added to that, what about our sons? In other words, should we be teaching our sons to reimagine and adapt their male familiar roles in response to this burgeoning of female Jewish leadership? I'll start with you.
I think the question of balancing your home life with a job outside the home is an important one, and it should definitely be discussed. But I don't think it's particular to women being involved in Jewish leadership, because there are a lot of professions which are very demanding at women's time. You know, my sister just finished her training as an infertility specialist, so the way she and her husband navigated her training with raising her two little kids was challenging. But discussion I think every family should have if the parents are both working. So I think when it comes to this job, this role in particular, you know, I would hope, you know, that, well, first of all, I would say that women, oftentimes women who are drawn towards to be leaders in their community, Jewish-wise, might do the same thing in the secular world if there was no option in the Jewish community. If the person who's drawn to be a teacher in the religious schools might be drawn to be a professor, right? We might have the same demand just outside the community. So I don't know if having women in the Jewish leadership roles would make that particular family more stressed. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that our communities, you know, we value families, we value children, we value the home life. So I would hope that they would be considerate and respectful to women in those positions, and that their spouses would be supportive in whatever professions their wives are doing.
I actually want to disagree with one of the points that you made. I think that when we're talking about leadership in the Jewish community, especially if it's tied to a particular shul, then I think it raises a conflict that maybe becoming a doctor or in some other profession doesn't raise, which is, and this is a conflict that luckily I don't face because the work that I do in Efrat is not connected with a specific shul, but I know it's something that certainly think that the Maharat's face, which is you're a woman working in a shul, you have kids, you have a spouse. How do you navigate the fact that as the assistant rabbi position, you need to be at every single one of the minyanim, and what happens to the husband and what happens to the kids? So I do see it as a very big conflict. I think it certainly involves re-educating men, but I think that it also involves perhaps as a community rethinking what are the different types of leadership that are needed, and what can the male leadership provide and what can the female leadership provide. last night when we were on the panel and Maharat Ruth Belinsky Friedman was speaking about her job in Washington, D.C., speaking about the fact that for the first I think year on the job, she was attending the morning minyan at 6:30. Now this is before she had any kids, but it just, it raised a question in my mind of, is this the best use of her time? In other words, should that be part of the job description that she has to attend the morning minyan at 6:30 when there are no other women there, and she's just coming there? I don't know. And I say this, I want to be very clear, as someone who from the age of 11 until I had my first child went to morning minyan every day. So someone who was coming from a strong commitment to that, but with life, I think I'm questioning the sustainability.
I hear that question. Before we moved to Toronto, my husband and I were working at Yale University as a JLIC educators. And that role, we were both hired to be educators for the Yale students. So when it came to, you know, being in shul, we both couldn't be in shul. We have two little kids running mm-hmm. around. So that question was very strong for me in terms of, should I be in shul and hire a babysitter to be with my kids on Shabbos morning? Or do I say, be with the kids? And I, you know, I personally chose to model for our students the fact that a Jewish home supports, you know, being a Jewish family means some go to minyan and some don't. And, you know, so I chose to, you know, bring my kids, they ran around shul, kind of somewhat, but to show that there are different roles that people have in their family. I could still be a Jewish leader without going to the 6:30 minyan. Mm-hmm. Other JLIC educators have chosen differently, and there have been some women who alternate, you know, with their husband to say, you know, it's important for once a week she goes to minyan to show the women that it's important for her to be there. So it's a struggle. But I think it is important to model that what a male leader does to be a male rabbi does is not the same exact tasks mm-hmm. that a female Jewish leader also has to do.
Yeah, and with that I agree 100%. And I think the model of hiring a babysitter to be with one's kids on Shabbos, which is something that people have told me that they've done, strikes me as very difficult, and I don't think that that's the model of female leadership that I want to be part of, personally.
So I appreciate that we're all discussing personal choice, and I think this is a good example, this panel, of respecting other people's choice. So if a maharat does decide, for example, to hire a babysitter to watch her children so she can go to minyan so her spouse can go to work, or during Chagim or Shabbat, we respect those choices. And I think that's the bottom line, is as women, we also support one another in our decisions and our choices of how we can be leaders. I think it's also fair to say that ideally, individuals are attracted to one another before they decide to partner and marry, and they know what they're getting into to a certain degree. I think that women or men who seek out leadership positions often have strong partners who support them being in those leadership positions, and also that facilitate them being in those leadership positions. A chronic issue that we know about is everybody's working too hard. Everybody's out of the home for too many hours a day. Two working parents, families are very stressful and challenging to both parties, and certainly to individuals who are not partnered and are raising children on their own, as is the case in many communities and certainly the Orthodox community as well. So for that reason, I think that your question about teaching the boys is important. We want to send a message from a very early age that families navigate and negotiate who is going to do what, and that's acceptable if they both agree to it, and that anything is possible, perhaps not all at the same time, but anything is possible for career opportunities, whether it's in Jewish leadership roles or any professional life that brings you outside of the home. I'll just add that I think shul life is very complex, because it's not like another job. I get calls from women about the mikvah, or about a question about kashrut, or about speaking on a panel at 10:30 Motzei Shabbat. And I am so delighted that I am available. I'm not always available. But I think shul life and the life of somebody in the rabbinate is different in that you're available all the time. You could be sitting in shul and in a moment of personal prayer, and somebody can tap you on the shoulder and say, I think the Eruv is down. And you can be walking home from shul, and somebody can say to you, oh, I need you to come back to shul because somebody locked the shul and nobody has the keys. So these questions, personal questions, not so personal questions, I think that is actually the biggest challenge, I think, for women and men in the rabbinate. And for that, we need as much support as possible from the community, from partners, and mostly from each other, I think.
I just want to say parenthetically that all this talk about people going to Minyan every day of their life at 6:30 in the morning is making me feel incredibly lax in my own observance. let's just spend a minute longer, and I'm going to finish up here. Do people have questions that they want to ask from the floor? Show of hands. Okay, so I'm gonna pop out with the mic in just a minute. Let's re-educate boys for a sec, specifically. What kinds of things do you think families' messages should be sending to boys that maybe they aren't sending right now?
I think the best way to message is to model. And I think that children, boys and girls, but for the sake of this specific discussion, we can talk about boys, though I fiercely believe in educating young people with like values, is to model parents can't always come home for dinner every night because parents have different work commitments, but the modeling of study, of advocacy work, of volunteerism, of tolerance, of open-mindedness, of gratitude. And gratitude would probably be at the top. Our strong messages that we can model. We can model our behavior for our community, for children, for one another. And change really comes from that type of modeling. But it's one step further. When we normalize roles, they become just that. They become normal. There are little boys running around in Maharat Ruth Bulinski's shul saying, she's a Maharat. I have to ask a Maharat this. I have to ask a Maharat that. There are boys who are, just today I spoke to my nephew and told him that there's going to be a party for my smicha. And although at first I think he was confused, he was mostly excited because he said that the way you become a rabbi is you daven all the time. So in other words, young people are sponges, and we can model behavior, we can normalize our titles, our positions, and I think that really is how change happens. But it's also, I'll be honest, it's for girls as well. I didn't grow up as a young girl with I grew up with the knowledge that in some parts of the Jewish tradition, women were rabbis. I didn't grow up with that in Orthodoxy. But I created my own narrative when I met Norma Baumel Joseph. And to me, she was a rabbi. And so we create our own narrative and our own understanding with what we're exposed to.
Final thoughts, the future. In football gambling, there's a term called over-under. You pick how many points are going to be in the game, and you choose either under the number or over the number. So, Sarah, official Yoetzet in Toronto, over, under, 5 years?
Under.
Under, okay.
For sure, under.
We live in hope. Dr. Rosenfeld will give you the last word. How do you see the future? I'm going to speak specifically here of the Israeli context, right? Because Israel, as we both know, is a very different dynamic, right? Because of the fusion of religion and politics, right? Which makes for quite a toxic cocktail at times. I want you to comment on if you think that the Israeli religious public is ready for this next step of kind of female spiritual leaders, halachic decisors, ultimately clergy.
I think that it is ready, but I think that it will look different than it looks in America. Shul life in Israel looks very different than it looks in America. You don't have, in many communities, there isn't a paid rabbi. In many communities, there isn't a rabbi at all. That's something that needs to be thought out when we're thinking about where the female leadership will come in. Because if the Maharat is coming into the shul and taking a rabbinic position, I find it harder to imagine that shuls which have no rabbis will suddenly take in just a woman. So I think that it's a different world. What will happen next is speculation. I mean, I think that it's no accident that I'm working in Efrat, and that this is under the vision of Rabbi Riskin, who made Aliyah himself many years ago, but he's an American who made Aliyah, and he came from an American rabbinical model when he came to Israel. So the question of this being replicated in other communities is a question for me. I think it's something that the community is ready for. And one thing that you do see, I don't know if it's more in Israel than America, since at this point I don't know really what's going on in America on this level, but you do see in organizations like Beit Hillel, where there are men and women involved in halachic debate and discussion and creating policy together, that's a place where women's voices have already entered. I don't know.
Gotcha. I don't know is always a good last word. I'm going to throw it open to the floor, but before I do, I think these three have earned a wonderful hand.
Thank you all for being here, for honoring us. I'm wondering if I would love to hear your opinions on taking some of the issues and challenges, exciting, that you face, and wonder if we can open it up and think that, what can we learn more about the Jewish community, the Orthodox Jewish community at large, from those same issues? I'm thinking two things in particular. One is the role of the pulpit rabbi or maharat, how that affects family and real life, how that affects the men as well, and is it time for a change in terms of how, with expectations of, and how we treat all of our clergy? And also in terms of titles. There's a lot of titles up here. There are a lot of titles around for women, female clergy. I personally find it curious that we use the term Rav to describe all kinds of men's clergy, including ones who have studied for many, many years, including some that come back after a summer with that title, including some that perhaps get it online. I mean, there's lots of different venues, different opportunities, perhaps different qualifications, and I find it curious, as we're a more and more educated laity, that we're just slapping that title on you if you're a man, even if you've had very different training than other men who call themselves rabbi. So I'm wondering if, by having an interest in titles because of women, if somehow we can enlarge the discussion about men as well in titles.
Okay, my name is Charles Bloom, and I am strictly Reform, not a rabbi, Reform Jew, okay? I belong to a conservative synagogue. And at the age of 76, I'm looking back over many years. And I can see that Orthodox and Reform and Conservative are gradually being affected by the feminist movement, very strongly so. And it's nice to see that the Orthodox are coming around as well. I learned of Maharat only recently, because the rabbi at Bet Tikva was talking about it as part of a sermon. My question is, how long do you think it will take before people, I'm not just talking about Orthodox now, but people in general, begin to accept Maharat rabbi, or whatever you want to call them, as all being the same.
Thank you.
Because that's a major, it's not going to happen overnight. It could take 100 years as far as I know.
Well, we both won't be here to see that.
Okay, I got a couple quickies, so I went back to get a pacifier and passed by Clanton Park, and a whole bunch of people from this shul were out there having a bonfire, and this shul just by coincidence has people who are Shomer Shabbos, not Shomer Shabbos, you know, gay men and people who go to the partnership minyan. But when I mentioned to someone there that this was going on, that is something that would divide those people over there at Clanton Park who are having the bonfire would not come back to the shul if there was a maharat or if there was someone even giving a talk. So it's even though there's all those other halachic things, for whatever reason, this is a very polarizing sort of thing from a social rather than probably halachic one. So just maybe if you could just address that fact, or what I think is a fact. And the other one is just related to what you mentioned, sort of laxity, your own personal laxity here, but having been in a number of congregations where women were given greater roles, Harvard Hiller, for example, where Lila is, when we waited for 10 women to make a minyan, that never happened because they never showed up. When they were given certain roles, it just didn't work because, as we all know, in the Haredi community, they're just an awful lot more serious about the amount of time they're investing. So there's no question that those who are more open to roles of women are also those who are a little bit, for the most part, and there are many exceptions, more lax in many areas of practice or learning or that sort of thing. That's a very broad statement, but I think overall, generally, it's true. And that's something I just think needs to be addressed a little bit.
There's been a very enduring debate, it seems, from the history of post-Civil War Reconstruction in the United States through the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s, the Gay Rights Movement in the U.S., and up until, I don't know, even the publication of, Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In, about whether the best way to affect change, and I'm sorry if I'm simplifying the two camps, but is to make change something that's palatable to the existing establishment, or by making the prospect of continuing without change something that is untenable for the establishment. And I'm wondering if you see either of those two points of view prevailing in your world, and what you think about which one is or isn't winning out.
Thank you. All right, let's begin with the first queries, which were about what does the emergence of female leadership / clerical roles teach us about how we treat all of our clergy, if it does at all?
I think that this is an issue of public life versus private life. I think this is an issue of how we take up time. I just read an article about written by a day school teacher who said all the parents complain that school is closed Erev Pesach because they want to do cleaning and they want their kids to be out of the house, but I'm a parent too and I need to clean my house. So I actually have to be home that day. So I think that we have some unrealistic expectations in the Jewish community when it comes to Jewish professionals, and I think there's a crisis really emerging, and more people, I think, are shying away from Jewish communal work because they're saying it's not good work for a nice Jewish boy or girl, and so I'm not sure that this is only an issue in the rabbinate. I do think that it is a struggle, though.
Put another way, the Jewish community eats its young. I'm not kidding. Gentleman asked how long before acceptance of female clergy, which I think we've been sort of talking about all along, and it's hard to speculate, I think, is what we were saying. There is obviously a growing trend towards it, and different communities within Orthodoxy will have different sort of attitudes to it. The next question, I wasn't quite clear, to be honest, but Taking the second question first, you seem to be suggesting, are women not as committed to learning halachic practice?
The communities who are generally more accepting of women in leadership positions tend to be less committed.
Well, the question is whether there's a correlation between the two, but I'll let you answer. Anybody?
I hear the question, and I think that I'll speak personally. It's something that bothers me, and it's something that definitely kept me away from this type of training and from moving into this type of role for a long time. The feeling that I didn't want to be part of something that was only, like you said, a movement of those who are less committed, and so if they're less committed in general, they're less committed about going to Minyan, so then they'll be less committed and not care if it's a woman who's leading the Minyan. To me, that's an upsetting phenomena, and actually, it's one of the things that led me to only come to this program in Israel rather than in America, because I think that in Israel, it's different. And coming into the program at Medrash at Lindenbaum, and just seeing the other women that I was learning with made me feel like I could call it a home. Again, in Israel and America, the community is different. What's out there is different. But I think that in Israel, you wouldn't find that same phenomena in terms of the Harvard Hillel phenomena.
And I would say, I haven't found that phenomenon at all. I mean, I think that the communities that have hired Yoetzot and turned to Yoetzot turns to them because they care about halacha, and they want to keep it correctly, and they want to ask their questions, right? They want to have an avenue to learn more, to think about it in a way that's comfortable. So, from my experience, I haven't witnessed that. I'll take your word that it exists, but in terms of the Yoetzot phenomenon, I don't think that it's the communities that are less observant or care less are the ones who have hired them.
I'll just add that no partnership minion has hired a woman to be the head of their community, which either means they're not as progressive as they say they are, or means something else. So I think that there's a struggle there. And the shuls that have hired women to this point, the women are hired by the Orthodox rabbi who's at the helm of the shul. There is a board vote. And those shuls are made up of a very diverse community. Some are Shomer Shabbat, some are not. But the hiring rabbi is an Orthodox rabbi. Actually, most of the rabbis who have hired women who have received smicha from Maharat are actually ordained by YU. It so happens up until this point, which is interesting in and of itself. So I think that communities are diverse. I don't think that the only communities that are hiring women or more open to women are perhaps made up by people who are more lax in their observance, though I think that progressive values are often felt in environments that don't initially feel like a mainstream Orthodox shul. That is probably true. I don't think that it's always going to be that way, and I think that the more shuls that hire women who have smicha from Maharat or from Midrash Lindenbaum or other places, the more this will change. And I actually think that when women have something to do in shul, they start showing up. And when women have a woman to look up to who's at the helm, they show up. So I would say that the critique is not on the women for not showing up. It's on the institutions for not making it into a place that women feel like they're necessary and like they have what to contribute when they're there. And I don't only mean participating ritually. I mean by making sure mechitza is always set up in a room when women come to daven, even if tefillah is held, let's say, in a Beit Midrash. I mean making those types of accommodations so women know that they have a place there right away. And I do actually think that women show up. I'll just give a quick example. I was saying Kaddish this year, and I was the only woman in the Young Israel where I was davening during the week. And after a few months of being in the shul three times a day davening, another woman showed up one day, and she said, I hear that it's very progressive here. I hear that women come here and they doven. And I thought to myself, this is so heartbreaking. But at the same time, just by one person showing up, other people started coming. So I think it's also about creating spaces, inclusive spaces.
The last question from the gentleman over here, actually quite an important question, really, about whether change should be tenable to the establishment or not. There's actually a parallel to this. I was reading recently about Malcolm X, that for young African-American males, it was Dr. King who created the large social macro change, but they did a study that in terms of heroic figures in the minds of young African males, it was definitely Malcolm X and not Dr. King. In other words, the change that was untenable was the one that really stuck in their minds. This, I think, comes back to what we were talking about before about the 5 to 10% and whether you want to make it comfortable or not too comfortable and so on. So anybody can take this. In other words, should change be, is it a good thing if we say change is exactly contoured to the tastes of the existing community, or is it better if we like actually move them into a zone of discomfort?
I mean, I think that the Orthodox community being what it is, again, not one thing, but the second thing that you said in terms of should change happen only when the situation proves to be untenable, I think something about that struck me as perhaps for some things, yes. In other words, I definitely like the model of change that happens organically and that the community grows towards, but I also think that there are some things where the community needs to be pushed towards. So I think there's probably a bit of each.
Yeah, I think we saw that with scandal in DC, that sometimes something had to break pretty badly, you know, for us to have a conversation of how to make things better. So you know, you hope you don't have to wait towards that, but sometimes, you know, change is hard, and sometimes there has to be, you know, a feeling of we really need something now. You know, the situation is not good enough that we should change. That drives it forward.
I think enough women are not coming to shul on Shabbat and not coming to shul on holidays and are feeling a tension, whether they can articulate it or not, that actually the system is broken. And I think it is becoming intolerant to, it's intolerable to many women who are in the movement. And you're faced with a choice, frankly. If you grow up committed to Orthodoxy and you want to pursue a certain type of leadership role, up until, in my experience, the establishment of Yeshivat Maharat, people would say to me, well, why don't you just go to Jewish Theological Seminary to get smicha, which is a fine institution. It's the institution that ordains conservative rabbis. And I said, because I'm not conservative. I'm Orthodox. So something had to come out of that, because I certainly think that the Orthodox movement has lost women and will continue to, and also men who feel disenfranchised for a variety of reasons. I mean, Orthodoxy is, there are no shortage of issues that we have to resolve in the Orthodox movement, and feminism and the feminist, the crisis for feminists and for women is but one of them. I think that for the first time in a very long time, we are creating some solutions though. And that gives us, that should give us reasons to feel very optimistic. I certainly feel more optimistic than I have in a very long time.
You know, when you talk about communal change, we'll end on this, as several people have noted in the past. When you talk about the radical halachic change, that term itself denotes communal failure. Because if a community comes to the point where it requires radical change, it means that you haven't been keeping your eye on the ball. In other words, things have been progressing and progressing and progressing, and you haven't taken note of it. So at some point late in the game, you say, whoops, this thing's been happening. We really, really need to change course. That's in some ways a signification of the fact that you haven't been paying attention all along, or you haven't taken seriously all along the things that need changing, and so you're now coming in and saying, oh, we've got to radically change this. And I think everybody here on this panel would agree that in a way, both the methodology of Orthodoxy and probably the sanest way of doing things is to do it an evolutionary fashion where you're little by little really paying attention to what's going on in your communities and making those changes. Anyway, it's our blessing that these talented women and many others should be instrumental in making that change. Thank you very much.
I just want to add that I found this an extremely inspiring evening, and I want to thank you, and I think I share your optimism. I got an email this week from somebody who's very upset, and I said, you know, slowly but surely, I think things are moving in a very positive way. We focus on all the problems in our community, and I found this, your intelligence and the articulate, how you articulate your views and the passion and commitment you have to our people is really beautiful. And whether you're male or female, we need more and more people like this, and I want to thank you. And thank you all for coming, and spread the word. Just before you leave, next week, a week tonight, Dr. Malamud is going to give a talk on what happened at Sinai. Revelation and its interpreters. I think that's the subtitle. That'll be a week tonight. I'll send out an email. If you still want to sign up, our Africa trip is sold out. There, I think, is room for two people on our Italy trip, a little room in Spain, room for Poland. So if you want to sign up, these are wonderful trips, also inspiring, but in a very different way. Inspiring in the past, this is inspiring for the future. So we need inspiration all around. And I think we should make a Maariv minyan. And I set up that one mechitza, and thank God it's not enough, so let's just add a few more panels so we can maybe have the men on that side and the women on this side. There are more women, so why not? Okay, we'll dive in 2 minutes.